The following program is produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.
What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Reach.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to Too Jewish with Rabbi Sam Kohan and Friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Dr. Richard Ablin, creator of the PSA test for prostate cancer. We'll also have a visit from our Mevina on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman, visiting correspondent Rabbi David Wilfond, storyteller Jordan Hill, and our expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. Too Jewish is sponsored this morning by Temple Emmanuel, a Reformed Jewish community for all of Tucson. Call 327-4501 for information on Arizona's finest synagogue, the only full-service Reformed congregation in southern Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We have an important historic occasion taking place locally this coming week. My own Temple Emmanuel, first Jewish organization founded in Arizona, 2 years before we even became a state, is celebrating its 100th anniversary. As the historic congregation in the state, we are very proud of the fact that we've been at the heart of Judaism in these parts for a century, that every single Jewish organization of note, including, by the way, the conservative and Orthodox congregations here in Tucson, has been a kind of offshoot of our own temple. We're delighted to celebrate this signal anniversary. I'm receiving a state proclamation next Wednesday in Phoenix, by the way, when I do the invocation for the legislative session. There are city and county and all kinds of public and private celebratory functions. Anyway, we are celebrating with a big gala this Saturday night and the presence on the pulpit of our temple a week from Friday, on March 26th, of Rabbi Eric Yaffe, a frequent guest of Too Jewish, and, by the way, the president of the Union for Reform Judaism, the umbrella organization of all Reform synagogues in America. But what really seems important about this is that our synagogue, which represents by far the most important institution of Jewish life in the world, the synagogue, is receiving some of its due locally. Often it's hard for temples like our own to get the kind of attention that should be ours for doing the important work of teaching, inspiring, and connecting Jews to this fabulous heritage of ours. But historical events give us the opportunity to recognize what is really great about our own communities. And this is one of those rare times. It calls for Shehecheyanu, a prayer for all special events in Judaism. Thank you, God, for allowing us to reach this day.
Oh, Lord.
That was the magnificent Shehecheyanu of Meir Machtenberg, as sung by cantor Alberto Mizrahi, celebrating Temple Emmanuel's 100th anniversary this coming week. Well, it is the springtime of the year, or at least the spring training of the year, when blossoms appear, the hills turn green, and the air is sweet and fresh. Hope springs into the air, too, a time of newness and life and goodness. Which means that Passover must be coming soon. Indeed it is, just 2 weeks and a day from now. Pesach is the ultimate festival of freedom, but it is also Chag Ha'aviv, the springtime holiday. Actually, there are four names for Passover in Hebrew. Chag HaPesach, Festival of the Paschal Offering, which includes the idea of Passover as a remembrance of the angel of death passing over the homes of the Israelites on the night of the slaying of the firstborn. Chag HaMatzot, Festival of Matzah, the unleavened flatbread. Chag HaAviv, Springtime Festival. And most importantly, Zman Chirutenu, the time or season of our freedom. All these play into our experience of this remarkable multidimensional holiday. Since Pesach's also the festival that requires the most advanced preparation of all, weeks of cleaning and preparing and inviting and cooking and, of course, eating, we formally begin our pre-Passover preview of Pesach music with a reggae version of the prayer for all new beginnings of holidays, a different take on the Shehecheyanu. So just a public service reminder, there are now 15 shopping days left before Pesach. It's time to hit the grocery stores for matzah and manischewitz and kosher for Passover desserts before they start selling out. In much sillier news, I have to release a word about the Oscar telecast that ran last Sunday night. I don't know how many of you still watch the Oscars, you know, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences show that grants small gold statuettes for the best work in movies in the past year. I used to watch every year as a kid and then gradually just stopped doing it. The show was always endlessly long. The awards seemed to be given for kind of random reasons and, you know, I stopped. But my wife, Wendy, convinced me that this year we all ought to give it another try. Well, after 4 hours of completely self-absorbed and pretty awful television, I can now honestly say that I will never again watch the Oscar ceremony. You know, after 3.5 hours, we were finally getting to the awards you might actually care about. Best Actor, Best Actress, Best Director, and Best Picture. And then they decided to do an elaborate presentation for each actor and Best Actress nominee. A sort of early eulogy for each of these, well, performers who are apparently all the most talented, generous, wonderful human beings alive. And they're probably nice to stray cats, too. When they finally finished these tributes and they gave out the awards, they basically didn't have enough time even to announce the nominees for Best Picture. They just shoved the statuette into the director and producer's hands and said, "Good night." Great advance planning for the most elaborate presentation the movie industry gets on TV all year. Makes you wonder how they manage to actually produce films that run 2 hours and sometimes make sense. All I can say is that anybody who watched this endless Oscar mess and complains that Shabbat services are too long or that rabbis' sermons are dull has absolutely no grounds for complaint. Weird bad dresses, terrible hairstyles, lame jokes, embarrassing acceptance speeches. Hi there, Jeff Bridges. And appearances by terrible actors you thought had finally and fortunately disappeared from the screen. Molly Ringwald? Judd Nelson? Jokes that stretched beyond the breaking point. Ben Stiller, dressed as an avatar, was funny for about, 30 seconds, but the shtick went on for 5 minutes. Well, it was all just a bloated, boring mess of a show dedicated to what values exactly? Well, in spite of the rather yucky experience of watching the Oscar, spectacle, there were a couple of funny moments. The best of them, for me, was comedian Steve Martin, who announced that the Best Supporting Actor winner, Christoph Waltz, from the film Inglourious Basterds, had played a Nazi who was hunting for Jews. looked out at the audience and said, "Well, Christoph, look, the mother lode." It was a pretty funny acknowledgement that so much of the film industry is completely Jewish. Ironically, Christoph Waltz himself, who played the Jew-hating Nazi colonel Hans Landa in the Quentin Tarantino movie, has a son from his first marriage to a Jewish woman who is now a rabbi in Israel. Wow, the Nazi hunter has a Jewish son who's a rabbi. In less successful news, three Jewish theme movies were nominated for Best Picture, A Serious Man in Education and Inglourious Basterds, and none took home the prize. And for the third year in a row, an Israeli film was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film, and for the third year in a row, it didn't win. After losses by Ajami this year, Beaufort last year, and Waltz with Bashir the year before, that still leaves Israel without a victory in the Oscars. In fact, the only Israeli to take home a prize is Moshe Mizrahi, director of the French-language film Madame Rosa, which won for Best Foreign Language Film way back in 1977. Well, still, if they keep getting nominated every year, perhaps next year, when God willing, the show will be less of a bloated mess. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning in a few minutes, which is not a bloated mess, by the way, we'll meet our guest, Dr. Richard Ablin, creator of the PSA test for prostate cancer and a leading expert in the treatment of that serious condition. He believes that testing and treatment have become a kind of overenthusiastic scandal. Find out why when he joins us on Too Jewish.
Arizona's first Jewish congregation celebrates a century. On March 20th, 2010, Temple Emmanuel turns 100, celebrating a century as the leader of Judaism in Arizona. Temple Emmanuel, the first Jewish congregation in Arizona, celebrates its 100th anniversary with a festive gala Saturday night, March 20th at 6 p.m. at the Hilton El Conquistador Resort. This centennial celebration will honor all of Temple's past presidents and Joan and Donald Diamond for their vision, leadership, and the dedication they have provided over these 100 years. This sparkling, historic occasion, Emmanuel was founded 2 years before Arizona achieved statehood, will feature dinner, live music and dancing, and a multimedia program with tales from the temple's remarkable history and dynamic present. All are invited to this once-in-a-century event. For more information on attending, offering a tribute, and supporting this historic evening, contact Jill Rich at jbr@dakotacom.net or call 520-349-0174. That's 349-0174. Or call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Passover is coming up fast, so why is this night different from all other nights? Because you can spend it with Rabbi Sam Kohan, enjoying a Seder in a way that makes Passover live and breathe as never before for every age. And this year, it's part of the 100th anniversary of Temple Emmanuel, which makes this an even more extraordinary night. To truly experience this great festival of freedom, join Rabbi Sam Kohan for a second night Passover Seder that's simply the finest in Southern Arizona. This celebration is on Tuesday night, March 30th at 6 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. Reservations are a must. Call 520-327-4501. The food is great and kosher, but it's the stories, songs, and spirit of Rabbi Kohan that'll make this a Seder you'll never forget. Learn, enjoy, laugh, cry, and eat well. Call 327-4501 to make your reservation now for Tuesday, March 30th, a memorable second night of Passover with Rabbi Sam Kohan. Or if you live on the northwest side of Tucson, there will also be a second night Seder in the northwest with Rabbi Ben Sharp. Call 327-4501 for more information on how to make this the best Passover ever through Temple Emmanuel.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Richard Ablin. Dr. Ablin is the one who discovered the antigen that's used in PSA testing, so important, well, maybe, in diagnosing cancer in men, particularly prostate cancer. He's a member of the Arizona Cancer Center, the University of Arizona College of Medicine, a research professor of immunobiology and pathology. He has served consecutively as director of the scientific investigation at Tetragenics Pharmaceuticals Incorporated and director of the immunobiology unit, Department of Urology and Research, associate professor of urology at SUNY Stony Brook, president of the Robert Benjamin Ablin Foundation for Cancer Research, which was founded in memory of his father. Dr. Ablin got his PhD in microbiology from SUNY Buffalo in 1967 and then continued his training in immunology as a U.S. Public Health Service postdoctoral fellow at the medical school under the late renowned distinguished professor Ernest Witebski. He is a very important researcher, and he recently did some diagnostic work and treatment work in Tanzania. Is that correct?
Yes.
So tell us a little bit about that experience.
Well, I had the privilege the first part of December at an invitation of they organized what was called the first National Prostate Cancer Conference, A Cry for Life. And I was invited and went to a city called Dar es Salaam, which I think transliterates to City of Peace. We had a very good meeting. There were about 150, 200 people at the meeting. And following the meeting, I was there for about another week, visited some of the hospitals and gave some lectures at a couple of the medical schools. The situation in Tanzania is directly the opposite that it is here in the United States, where, as you've probably seen and heard in the medical literature or the media, we're currently experiencing an overdiagnosis and overtreatment of prostate cancer. It's directly the opposite in Tanzania. And so one of the purposes that I went there was to try to educate the people, and not only about prostate cancer, but about the importance of diseases of the prostate in general, which if they end up being a chronic, for example, prostatitis, which is an infection of the prostate in many cases, chronic prostatitis in many cases possibly can give way to prostate cancer. And so the purpose was to try to educate the people and explain to them the importance of diseases of the prostate in general.
We will talk much more extensively with Dr. Richard Ablin about prostate cancer, its diagnosis, its treatment, and overtreatment, which is a very controversial and interesting subject, when we come back here on Too Jewish.
If your parents or other loved ones are in need of assisted living, consider making the choice that Dorothy Daniels' family made, Handmaker.
Living at Handmaker does make me feel very independent, like I was still in my house. The best part of it is I don't have to clean it.
Assisted living at Handmaker promotes an active and independent life. All needs are met, including weekly housekeeping and linen service, transportation to doctor's appointments, restaurants, banks, and shopping. And living at Handmaker is fun.
Every 2 weeks, there is a man who comes with a saxophone, and we dance, and I love that because I love to dance.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grant, and includes 1 and 2 bedroom suites and cozy studios with patios and balconies.
I would recommend Handmaker to anyone because I feel very safe and secure here. The people that work here are very nice, considerate, and that means a lot.
For a tour and consultation, call 322-7035 or visit their website at handmaker.org.
Looking for a unique dining experience with menu selections made from scratch from the freshest ingredients? The Beeline, located at 621 North 4th Avenue, sets a new precedent with high-quality food and beverages in a counter-service setting. This blend has earned the Beeline the Best Casual Dining Award from Tucson Weekly 5 times. From their perfectly spiced mahi fish tacos to their popular pasta dishes featuring vodka, pesto, or traditional Italian red sauce, you are sure to find something perfect for your taste. Try their scrumptious dessert selection, carefully prepared from scratch by their talented pastry chef. Enjoy wines by the glass or bottle, microbrew, craft beers are on tap. The Beeline, 621 North 4th Avenue. Stop by or call 882-7575. Visit their retail location, Time Market on University Boulevard near 4th Ave, with a great selection of over 300 different wines and 100 beers and gourmet foods to go. Call 882-7575 for the Beeline and and Time Market. Unique casual dining experiences. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, email us at 2jewishradio@yahoo.com or call 520-327-4501 or visit our website at 2jewishradio.com. You can also get CDs of all past and present shows through the website or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. To continue our pre-Passover preview of music, for Seder's coming up Monday, March 29th, we offer up the table of contents from the Passover Haggadah musically, Kadesh Urchatz. Kadesh Urchatz, Kavos Yachatz, Magid Vachsam, Otzi Matzah, Mator Kodesh Urchatz, Molech, Tzavut Malech, Kadeh Nitzah. As my father, Rabbi Baruch Kohan, likes to say, the Haggadah is the only book in which we sing the table of contents. You know, there are 15 elements of the Passover Seder, and there are now only 15 shopping days left until Pesach. Time to get ready. We welcome our new correspondent, Rabbi David Wilfund, the Gingy, here to 2 Jewish. Good morning, David.
Hi, Sam.
You know, I don't think I've called you David in years.
That's okay. It's a great name. I like it, too.
Gingy, by the way, means a redhead, and you certainly are, as are two of my kids, and me a little bit. You are also a North American, what they call a North American Israeli, that is an Israeli who was born in the United States, made Aliyah. Tell us a little bit about that.
Two funny stories. When I first arrived in Israel at the airport making Aliyah, I go up to the passport check-in counter and give my passport. It's got Aliyah visa stamped on it. I give it to the visa, the passport woman, and she looks at me for a while in the face and says, "Go back." I said, "What?" She said, "Go back." I said, no, you don't understand. I'm making Aliyah. I really want to live here. And she said, "No, go back. Go back to the end of the room. There's a special door you've got to go through." So I went to the end of the room. I was like in shock. And there is this door, and I walked up all the steps, and I looked down after I got up to the top of the steps, and I counted. There are 22 steps. So I call that the 22 steps of Aliyah. So if you ever wondered how many there are 22. I got to the top of the steps. There's this huge hall with like maybe 500 chairs in it. It's the entire top of the airport. It's this giant hallway. What I find out is that this is where they usually put the plane loads of the Ethiopians and the Russians who used to land. My plane was from New York, so I was the only person making Aliyah. The lights were half off. The place was just kind of dark and dusty. And eventually, after screaming, "Hello, hello," for like 5 minutes, some old lady comes out and says, "Are you a new immigrant? Are you an Ole Chadash?" And I said, "Yes," and fills out the forms and eventually lets me go. What's it like to be an American? I'm having a Shabbat lunch with my neighbors who are Moroccan. And at lunch, they start telling me, "We hate the Ashkenazim." And they go on for about 10 minutes telling me all the terrible things that Ashkenazim have done to them. And then it suddenly clicks to me, oh my gosh, they don't think I'm Ashkenazi. So I asked them, "Listen, these Ashkenazim sound pretty bad. How would I recognize one if I saw them?" And they say, "Well, they have those Polish accents and those Russian accents." And I realize that they see me as American and not an Ashkenazi Jew, even though I see myself as Ashkenazi. That was fascinating to me. In summary, I would say this. In the Bible, they talk about 12 tribes of Israel. Nothing's changed. We have tribes today. There's a tribe called the Ethiopians, a tribe called the Russians, a tribe called the Moroccans, a tribe called the Yemenites, and there's this funny tribe called the Americans. And I'm one of those guys, the American Jews, and we're finding our place, and we're part of the mosaic and part of the story that's here in the modern land of Israel.
Sort of part of the mosaic in this case.
You got it. Exactly.
Gingy, thanks very much. Great stories. We will talk next week.
My pleasure. Be well.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Bye-bye. We welcome our expert on Jewish ethics, Amy Hirschberg-Letterman. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We have been talking about love and sex and sexuality and sexual identity
I hear our ratings have gone up enormously
over the last couple
of years.
Everybody's interested. Too Jewish, had too much sex, besides. We spoke about the reform and conservative movements in particular, the reform movement's acceptance of gays and lesbians, the gradual movement, the conservative movement towards an acceptance of that. Orthodox world hasn't really officially changed at all, and you could even call it strongly, if not sometimes violently, anti shall we say, sexual diversity. Although there are people like Rabbi Steve Greenberg who are at work, who are openly gay Orthodox rabbis, something you would not have seen 20 or 30 years ago.
And I think it's a wonderful thing. You know, I had the pleasure of being both a colleague and a friend of Steve's before and after he came out. One of the biggest problems within the Orthodox community, which his movie Trembling Before God, as well as his book, really explores, is this horrible problem of a classically committed Jew who truly wants to live a Torah life who is gay. And, you know, I'd like to suggest that in his book, in Steve's book, he brings the wonderful example of when science really establishes evidence that is indisputable, that classical Jewish thinking and halakha can be reapplied. And he gives the example of the deaf mute who was thought prior to the early 1900s, to actually be more of an imbecile, and so wasn't counted in a minyan because they weren't seen as adults. But once science established that that was not the case, the halakha changed, and deaf mutes are permitted in minyans, which, of course, goes to the issue of choice. If and when homosexuality and any kind of transgender or other relationship, sexually based relationship, is established as being not a matter at all of volition, but as a both a genetic and a predetermined, you know, hardwired kind of status, it is possible, and there is precedent, that the Orthodox, that the halakha will be reapplied to look at that as differently than it's presently looked today, so that truly Torah observant Jews will not have to live a lie in conventional marriages based on a false premise, or become so depressed that they, you know, sometimes resort to suicide or have to live a celibate life, you know, a loveless life. So I think there's a lot of positive things happening, and certainly there is some precedent for change if science establishes the origins of homosexuality.
Very interesting. We can hope that there'll be, I don't know the right way to phrase it, relief, a certain level of acceptance in the Orthodox world that has not yet permeated it. Thanks very much, Amy. We'll talk next week.
My pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, from Two Jewish Storyteller Jordan Hill, and get the old Jewish joke of the week. We visit weekly with Janos Wilder, the outstanding restaurateur of J-Bar and Janos Restaurant. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
J-Bar's got all kinds of great things going now. Winter Harvest Menu, Recession Busters. Tell us about them.
Well, the Winter Harvest Menu, choice of three main courses, great dishes, all of them geared for this time of year, $12.95. And the Recession Busters, which I'm hoping soon will be the recovery menu.
God willing.
Absolutely. A steak. Right now we're doing a New York strip steak, certified Angus beef with all the J-Bar fixing, chorizo, black beans, salsa, slaw, tortillas, $20.
What a great couple of deals. What's the number for the J-Bar?
615-6100. Or you can go online, website www.janos.com.
That's J-A-N-O-S.com. Great meals, great prices at the J-Bar all winter. 615-6100, Janos and the J-Bar.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been exploring borders and boundaries in Judaism and in Judaism's relationship to the world. One of the ones that we didn't talk about, although, by golly, it's sort of an obvious one, the ways that we make distinctions in food, in kashrut, and that
comes up this time of year. The month of Nisan begins in a couple of days. It's the month of Passover. People are more interested in being kosher and what it means to be kosher and kosher for Passover at this time of year than any other. You could say it's the most boundaried part of the year.
Right, because we add another whole layer of distinctions and another whole cabinet full of dishes and cutlery, and in some cases two or three more cabinets full of cutlery and stuff. So, you know, in the dietary laws, which were designed originally to help Jews establish themselves as a separate nation, different from the other people around them who were living in the land of Israel when the Jews arrived after the Exodus from Egypt, which we're about to commemorate in 2 weeks, there was a set of rules that sort of arbitrarily said, these foods are permitted, these foods are forbidden. Contrary to what many people claim, this has nothing to do with health or sanitation or lack of refrigeration. It's simply arbitrary lists. These foods are okay, these foods are not okay. And then the rabbis went on to add to this, but in the same sense, not only what's okay and what's not okay, but we separate dairy and meat. So we have different dishes and different pots and different cutlery. Some people even have different sinks and different dishwashers. But the point is distinctions. And on Passover, we had another whole level, because in addition to the normal thing of what's kosher and what's not kosher, what's dairy and what's meat, we also have what's leavened and therefore not permitted during Passover, and what's unleavened and therefore permitted. Or as our grandparents would have said, what's Pesach Dik and what's not Pesach Dik. And so these distinctions help us mark separations. The specialness of this 8-day period is different from the rest of the year, in part because we add distinctions and more boundaries to the way we live, which is already plenty full of boundaries. And it's also interesting to me, at least, that in today's world, we often say of somebody who annoys us, of he knows no boundaries, or he doesn't have any boundaries, or he doesn't recognize, he's got a problem with boundaries.
Problem with boundaries.
This
right.
is like psychobabble now. It's very popular for describing some aspect of someone's behavior that you don't like. But it goes back to this very basic thing that we've been talking about over the last few shows about boundaries and distinctions and borders. And I think we're sort of slowly getting at something that really is at the heart of a people's identity, both an individual and a community and a nation. Certainly, it's at the heart of Islamic identity. It's at the heart of Jewish identity. It may be the essence of what separates humans from animals, even.
Fascinating. And really, conceptually, part of what makes us Jews, of course, is a desire to explore these ideas in a meaningful and way to affirm one of those differences, holiness.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Rabbi Shmuel is leading a Torah study group at the shul when all of a sudden an angel appears. The angel says to the rabbi, "Rabbi Shmuel, you are an example to all of your fellow men. You are totally unselfish. Your behavior is faultless. Your study of Judaism extensive. Your giving of tzedakah of charity is exemplary. In return for being such a mensch, Rabbi Shmuel, I'm going to offer you a choice of your reward. You can either have infinite wealth, infinite health, or infinite wisdom. What will it be, Rabbi Shmuel? Wealth, health, or wisdom? Whatever you choose, your wish will be instantly granted." Without any hesitation, Rabbi Shmuel replies, "I would love to have infinite wisdom." "Mazel tov to you, Rabbi Shmuel," says the angel. "It's done. Enjoy." And the angel disappears as quickly as it had come. For a few moments, there's stunned silence in the Torah study group. No one can believe what just happened in front of their eyes. Then one of the study group breaks the silence. "Rabbi Shmuel," he asks, "why don't you test your newfound wisdom right away? Say something really wise to us, Rabbi." And Rabbi Shmuel replies, "Oy vey, I should have taken the money." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. We now welcome our two Jewish storyteller, Jordan Hill. Good morning, Jordan.
Good morning, Rabbi. There was once a prince who was training to become the king. And as he was finished with many of his princely studies, his father sat him down and said, "Now I want you to do something different. I want you to learn a craft, something you can do with your hands." And the prince said, "But father, why would I need to know that? I'm going to be king." And the father said, "Just trust me." And so the prince decided to learn how to be a rug weaver. And he trained under all of these different masters, and he worked at it for years and years until finally at the end of it, he had woven this beautiful rug with all of these different vines covered in roses and thorns intertwined in this beautiful pattern. And everyone who looked at it, including his father, knew that his prince, his son, had achieved mastery. Now he sat him down again, and he said, "Now, son, let's continue with your princely studies. I want you to disguise yourself as a commoner so that no one knows you are the prince. And I want you to walk amongst your subjects so that you know what they are talking about, what they are feeling and thinking. This is the best way to understand, to be a good ruler." And so his son did just that, and he disguised himself as a commoner, and he went walking amidst the town, and he was doing this day after day after day, studying, learning, taking things in, when one day he was out there and feeling a bit hungry. And so he went to a certain restaurant, but no sooner had he walked in the door than the floor gave way beneath him, and he fell into a pit. And as he was scrambling to get out of the sides, finding it almost impossible, a face appeared in the hole above him and said, "Ah, I serve the best meat in town, and the reason is, it comes from the likes of you. Prepare yourself." And the prince, he thought fast, and he said, wait, I have very little flesh on my bones. Please, it will get you so little gold. I know the specific carpet tastes of the king himself. If you bring me the equipment, I can weave you a carpet that will give you tons of gold if you sell it to the king." And the shopkeeper thought about this, and it seemed like a good business proposition. And so he brought the supplies, and down there in the pit, the prince worked day and night, night and day, down to the bone of his fingers, making this rug, a rug with all of these vines with thorns and roses woven amongst themselves. And when he was done, the shopkeeper looked at it and saw the quality, and grinning, brought it right to the palace of the king. And as soon as he unrolled it for the king, the king recognized the work of his son, but he didn't say a word. He offered to pay whatever the shopkeeper asked for, and as the shopkeeper was returning to his restaurant, the king had him followed by guards. So that as the shopkeeper opened the trap door and was sneering down at the prince, the guards jumped on him, tackled him to the ground, and dragged him back to the palace. And as for the prince, he also returned to the palace, and in time, he became the king himself. And in spite of that rather traumatic experience, he continued dressing as a commoner, studying the ways of his people. And in this way, he ruled for the rest of his days with wisdom and with justice.
Thanks, Jordan. We'll get another story next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we begin the middle book of the Torah, Leviticus. The Hebrew name comes from its first word, Vayikra, God called. It's a book filled with ritual observance and rites designed to create and nurture sanctity. But it begins in an interesting and instructive way. There's a famous idiosyncrasy about the Aleph, the last Hebrew letter in the first word of the book, Vayikra, as it's written in the Torah, because it's written much smaller than the other letters. Aleph, the Midrash tells us, is the first letter of the word ani, I. Therefore, if we wish God to call us directly, we must diminish our focus on I and seek to limit our egotism. If we can do that, then we, like Moses, will be able to clearly hear God's call, to respond, and so to find the holiness that makes up the central subject of this book of Leviticus. Less of the I allows more of God. Only when we diminish the centrality of our self-absorption can we allow God in. Leviticus focuses on the way our ancestors worshipped God through animal sacrifice, korbanot. For the past 1900 years, since the destruction of the Second Temple in Jerusalem, prayer and study and acts of charity and repentance have replaced sacrifice. These are all ways to open ourselves to God and diminish our emphasis on the self. The great English author D.H. Lawrence, better known as a racy novelist, wrote a fascinating poem on the subject of sacrifice. The old idea of sacrifice was this: the blood of the lower life must be shed for the feeding and strengthening of the handsome, fuller life. Oh, when the old world sacrificed a ram, it was to the gods who make us splendid, and it was for a feast of meat, for men and maids on a day of splendor, for the further splendor of men. It was the eating up of little lives, even doves, even small birds, into the dance and splendor of a bigger life. There is no such thing as sin. There is only life and anti-life. Sacrifice is the law which enacts that little lives must be eaten up into the dance and splendor of bigger lives with due reverence and acknowledgement. You know, Lawrence's poem is powerful, but it really states the opposite of the Jewish view of sacrifice. Sacrifice in the Torah was a way to accept not that small lives should be given over for the sake of our more important lives. No, not at all. Instead, it was a method to connect us to the fact that our own existence is holy only when we offer ourselves to God. By giving up something, in this case, a bit of our own self-importance, we can give our lives meaning and sanctity. When we come back on Too Jewish in a few moments, we'll get the news of Jews around the world and talk with a controversial developer of the PSA test for prostate cancer, Dr. Richard Ablin, about the dangers of over-treating and over-testing prostate cancer, which affects so many men, when we come back on Too Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
Arizona's first Jewish congregation celebrates a century. On March 20th, 2010, Temple Emmanuel turns 100, celebrating a century as the leader of Judaism in Arizona. Temple Emmanuel, the first Jewish congregation in Arizona, celebrates its 100th anniversary with a festive gala Saturday night, March 20th at 6 p.m. at the Hilton El Conquistador Resort. This centennial celebration will honor all of Temple's past presidents and Joan and Donald Diamond for their vision, leadership, and the dedication they have provided over these 100 years. This sparkling, historic occasion, Emmanuel was founded 2 years before Arizona achieved statehood, will feature dinner, live music and dancing, and a multimedia program with tales from the temple's remarkable history and dynamic present. All are invited to this once-in-a-century event. For more information on attending, offering a tribute, and supporting this historic evening, contact Jill Rich at jbr@dakotacom.net or call 520-349-0174. That's 349-0174. Or call Temple Emmanuel at 327-4501.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
An interesting controversy has been swirling through the Orthodox world, or at least the Orthodox world in New York City. Rabbi Avi Weiss is the senior rabbi of the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, founder and dean of Yeshivat Chovevei Torah, the open Orthodox yeshiva in New York. Last March, about a year ago, Rabbi Weiss, who has received many awards, including Rabbi of the Year by the New York Board of Rabbis, and has been included in various publications as among the most important Jewish leaders in America, Rabbi Weiss conferred the title of Maharat on a woman, Sarah Hurwitz, indicating that she had the status of a near rabbi. Hurwitz had completed the course of rabbinic study and passed all the same exams that men must complete in order to be an ordained Orthodox rabbi, something that has never happened in the Orthodox world. Sarah Hurwitz has been a longtime member of the clergy staff at Weiss's own synagogue, which is an important Orthodox institution itself. Well, there was some controversy about the new term Maharat being conferred on a woman scholar, but in general it didn't spark great resistance. The term is an acronym for Manhiga Hilchati Ruchanit Toranit, which roughly translates to mean a spiritual and legal guide, and Maharat Hurwitz began teaching publicly with that title. But in January of this year, perhaps sensing that Maharat wasn't a title that was being widely understood or accepted, Rabbi Weiss changed her title, or perhaps ordained her more formally, would be a better way of saying it, as a Rabbah, which means more simply the feminine of Rav, a teacher. It's not quite Rav, but it's very, very close. Ah, but using the term Rabbah, which sounds like rabbi, provoked an Orthodox firestorm of negative reaction. God forbid there should be a woman rabbi in the Orthodox world. So this week, Rabbi Weiss backed down, something he doesn't do much. In an agreement with the Rabbinical Council of America, Weiss promised he would not ordain any more women with the title Rabbah. The announcement, made in a letter to the president of the Rabbinical Council of America, distributed by the council on March 5th, followed weeks of buzz in Orthodox circles, as well as rumors that the association was preparing to rescind Weiss's membership. In an accompanying statement, the RCA expressed satisfaction at the controversy's resolution and support for appropriate leadership roles for women. You know, all of this will seem quite backward to reforming conservative Jews long conditioned to female rabbis and cantors. After all, we first ordained a woman rabbi in the Reform movement in 1972. That was Rabbi Sally Prezant when McGovern was running for president, for Pete's sake. But in the Orthodox world, this represents the first serious crack in the wall of male resistance to Orthodox ordination of women. Some of these cracks have been plastered over this week, but watch. More will come in the future. And in smaller but sad news, actor Corey Haim died, whose name really should have been pronounced Chaim, by the way, possibly of drug complications, at the age of 38 last week. A Jewish kid from Toronto, he was a teen heartthrob back in the 80s, starred in a vampire movie, and tried numerous comeback attempts from drug addiction, some with his fellow one-time teen idol and TV show co-star, the also-Jewish Corey Feldman. Another unnecessary death. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Dr. Richard Ablin. He is a distinguished professor of immunobiology and pathology, University of Arizona College of Medicine, a research professor. He has served in a variety of other functions, both in research and in teaching faculty. It was his discovery of the antigen that can be identified by the PSA testing that led to a dramatic increase in diagnosis and treatment of men's prostate cancer, but that's not always a good thing. Can you tell us a little bit about, first of all, how you discovered this testing process and how it should be used and how it is used now?
Well, I discovered it in the process, to make a long story short, was doing some work in trying to improve treatments for prostate cancer in the mid-60s when I was back in Buffalo. And we pioneered a technique called cryosurgery, which is freezing of the prostate instead of a surgical remover. In the process, we observed some immunological reactions. That is, the body was producing an immune response to the cancer, and we wanted to try to find out what substances or proteins, as we call them, or antigens, were responsible. So that led me to the discovery of what are referred to as prostate tissue-specific antigens or prostate-specific antigen. The reason why we call it prostate-specific is because it's only found in the prostate. Now, the problem here is that there's two uses for the PSA test. One use is almost unquestionably the other. There's been a lot of question about it, and I've raised a lot of question about it. The excellent use of the PSA test is when a person has been diagnosed with prostate cancer and they've been treated because, as I said, of the fact that this protein is only found in the prostate. When the prostate is removed or destroyed by other forms of treatment, there should be no source of this protein in the blood. And so by doing periodic follow-ups following treatment of prostate cancer, one can determine if there's an increase in the level of PSA. That suggests that perhaps either all of the cancer, the malignancy, was not removed, or there is what we call an extra prosthetic source of the cancer. That is it's in other parts of the body.
It's metastasized somewhere else, moved somewhere else in the body.
That's correct. The other use there is that if a person is diagnosed or found to have prostate cancer, one can use the PSA test to monitor. In other words, you measure your PSA, for example, on the 1st of January, you see what the level is. Then maybe in July, you take another determination, and having a baseline, you follow whether there's an increase. The problem with the PSA test, and where the test has been misused and has become a tool of basically a money-making tool, unfortunately, has been used in screening. And the problem here is that, if you recall, I said that the antigen or the protein is specific for the prostate. But the key here that all men should understand is that this protein is not specific for prostate cancer. So therefore, in two other conditions of the prostate, prostatitis or in benign prostatic hypertrophy, which is an enlargement of the prostate that we all experience over the age of 40 and is responsible for us maybe getting up one or two times a night to urinate because we're not emptying our bladder, can have elevations of PSA.
You know, there's a certain concern about screening in general. Breast cancer screening is very important, and we've heard a lot about that. And prostate cancer screening, we've heard a great deal about now, too, at least guys have. Guys who are slightly over 40. The truth is, though, that some of the treatment for prostate cancer probably doesn't prolong life.
No, the problem here is that the morbidity associated, depending, I mean, there's different types of treatment which we can't go into, but basically the general treatments are radical prostatectomy, which is the surgical removal of the prostate gland, radiation therapy, in some cases cryosurgery, and there's other variations. But by example, in the case of radical prostatectomy, the recurrence rate within 5 years is anywhere between 25 to 35%, and the morbidity associated with it can be as high as 60%. This, of course, is not at a center of excellence, but just in general, that impotency can be as high as 60%, and incontinence can be as high as 30%. And when you go to your urologist, and the urologist says, "Don't worry about anything, we can fix everything," that's not really the proper
approach. Now, who should get screened and who shouldn't get screened otherwise for prostate cancer?
Well, if you're an asymptomatic man,
now, there's nothing showing, you're not having pain, you're not
no blood in your urine, no back pain, and no first degree relative. Unless some people are curious, there would be no reason to be screened. On the other hand, if you have a first-degree relative, you have symptoms. Obviously, if you have symptoms regardless of your age, you should go to the urologist. But if you have no symptoms and you're in your 40s, 45, 50 years of age, and you have a first-degree relative that had prostate cancer, then what you would do is what we call, which could result in what we call watchful or active surveillance. That is that you go to the urologist, they do a PSA, they may do a biopsy, they may find something, which again we can't tell in most cases whether it's going to be the turtle or the rabbit, and you watch it.
I want to thank Dr. Richard Ablin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about prostate cancer, about what the PSAs mean from the guy who helped develop the test?
If they go to www.prostatefoundation.org, they'll find our website.
There's also a phone number, 520-622-8319.
Yes.
And they can find out more about it. Thank you so much, Dr. Ablin.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be comedian Richard Lewis, one of the funniest and most Jewish of popular comics at work today. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from our pre-Passover musical, A Preview 2. It's Safam's version of the Passover song, B'tzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, when Israel went out of Egypt. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
B'tzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, Beit Yaakov Me'am Eloheis, Haita Yehuda Likadsho, Yisrael Mamshilo.
The preceding program was produced and paid for by Temple Emmanuel.